We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hello, my name is Michelle, and I am an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date of September 26, 2009. I just celebrated 14 years of recovery. I have a sponsor. Her name is Claudia. And I like to say that she knows that I am her sponsee. I share absolutely everything with Claudia, and she's been my sponsor for the last, 4 years. My journey started as most of us did. I am addicted to any mind-altering drugs. I loved alcohol, and I could remember as a young person, I want to say my first drink was when I was 14 years old. I come from a really good family, and I have two parents that are still married. They were very young when they had me and my brother. They were 19 with two children. I was born in Burbank, California. We lived in the valley for, until I was about 8 years old. I could remember as a child, I knew that there was something different. I had a lot of love from my parents, from my family. I come from a really big family of cousins and aunts and uncles, and I grew up with them. I was very close to my grandmother. We spent a lot of time with my grandmother because my parents worked a lot. My dad was gone during the day and my mom worked at night. I could remember when we moved here to Cerritos, California, is where I actually grew up. And I could remember I loved alcohol and I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be a part of the cool kids crowd. I was picked on a lot. My mother was a hairdresser and she worked in the beauty business. So I was always dressed in nice clothing. And I could remember being a young kid and getting my hair highlighted as like being her test model. And when I grew up, it was one of those things that wasn't heard of. And I could remember being teased at the kids that your hair color is different, your clothes are ugly, but I just wanted to fit in. And I would get into a lot of trouble. I'd cut school, I would go to parties. And I could remember the first time that I took my first drink. I was 14. I was at Knott's Berry Farm, and we had enough money to buy a bottle of Tickle Pink. And it was us girls were going to share it. And I could remember I drank a majority of it and got sick and threw up. And my parents were called and they came to pick me up. And I was grounded for the summer. And I would smoke cigarettes, but I could remember everybody outside playing. And I was the one that was inside because I was always grounded. I was always in trouble, whether it be bad grades at school, whether I talked back, or I was hanging out with the wrong crowd. And fast forward, we went into high school and I made it in there by the skin of my teeth. And then I went to continuation school, Tracy High School here in Norwalk. And I thought, this is going to be so cool. I'm going to be able to smoke on campus because they had a smoking section. And that's really all I cared about, is that I wanted to be cool and I wanted to be different and I wanted to fit in with the crowd, the bad boy club. And I actually flunked out of Tracy High School. I could remember begging my parents, please let me just get a job. I promise you I will get a job. Just let me take my GED and get out of school, because I was the only blonde-haired girl in school. I was in school with gangbangers and I was able to convince them. I had the gift of gab and I was able to get myself out of anything. And I was a liar at a young age. I lied about everything and my mom would always catch me in lies. And I would lie about the dumbest things. You know, I didn't know how to tell the truth. I can remember getting a job and I was a waitress. And I worked at a little restaurant called South Street Deli in Cerritos. And I found trouble there. Not only was I drinking excessively, I discovered cocaine. And that's what everybody at the restaurant did. The managers did it. The busboys did it. The busboys were the ones that supplied it to us. There was like a whole thing going on there. And I had a boyfriend at the time, and he was my high school sweetheart. And he used to get into a lot of trouble. And he too came from a really good home. And we were together off and on, and we would drink. We had a good time. But my parents always knew that if something were to happen to me, that his family was taking care of me, because my family knew that he also too came from a good home, that us two together were just trouble. And I had no fear. I had no fear whatsoever. I didn't care what the consequences would be. I didn't care that we were getting into trouble and we were doing things that we weren't supposed to. That continued on for a lot of years. And when I was, I want to say about 20 or 21, he and I had broken up and we were back and forth for a while. And I was hanging out with more of the restaurant crowd and getting into more trouble. I would drink excessively through the restaurant. I would get alcohol through the restaurant. And basically my tips and everything that I was making there was covering all my habits. And one day I just woke up and I was like, I don't want this for myself. I want something better. And I got a different job and I went to work at the auto club in Anaheim, and I had a pretty good job there. And I always maintained my jobs because I always knew that this had to take care of me because my parents weren't going to forever. I grew up in a good home. Like I said, you know, my parents are successful people. They've been together since they were 14 years old. And when I was 20, my parents had another child. And I loved this baby. I loved my youngest brother. And I took care of him a lot because my mom was building her business. My father was building his business. So I spent a lot of time with him. And I would clean up my act when he was in my care. And then I would party on the weekends. And I lived with my family. And I want to say I moved out at 18. And then I went back when I was 21. And then I went back when I was 23. So I would, you know, move out with friends that didn't work out. And then I would move home. And I would always have to clean up my act when I would go home because my parents had a new child. And so I want to say the boyfriend and I broke up for the final time. And I was extremely heartbroken because I knew I wasn't going back. And I cleaned up my act, and then I married the first person that was really nice to me, so I thought. And I'll never forget, his name was Tim. I introduced him to my family. My family loved him. And I got engaged, I want to say when I was 23. And I could remember my parents planned this elaborate wedding for me. And I think it was 8 weeks before I was getting married, my mom came to me and said, "Listen, Michelle, is this really what you want to do with your life? I just feel like this isn't the right fit for you." And she's like, "We're not worried about the money. We're not worried about anything. We just want to make sure you're happy." And I was, remember thinking, I was so offended. Like, how dare you question what the decisions that I'm making? This is a right fit for me. And at 25, I thought that this was it, that I was too old, and nobody's going to ever want to be in a relationship with me. And this was the best I was going to get. And I was settling for it. And he and I did a lot of drugs. My parents were very unaware of it because I was hiding it well. And I married that man and had this elaborate wedding that my parents paid for. We lived together. And I could remember after everything was done, all I cared about was the party. All I cared about was to have the very best wedding and the very best party that people would talk about forever. That's all I cared about. I didn't care about the marriage, didn't care about him. And it showed throughout the years that I was married to him. Again, I got to that place in life where all we do is Coke on the weekends. We drink throughout the week and I get up and I barely make it to work. And I thought, I want a family. I'm not going to settle for this the rest of my life. I want a family. I want a career and I'm not going to have it with him. And I left him, divorced him, got on with my life. I pulled my life together. You know, I worked and I lived alone for a while. Then I met my second husband and we had a good time, and he was a fireman with the LA County Fire Department. I had since switched careers and was working a sales job, an outside sales job for the beauty industry. And my mom helped me get that job because I was helping her at the salon part-time. And I had a lot of fun. It was a good job. I was no longer using drugs. I drank, but not excessively. I managed to pull it together, get up and go to work. And I was actually proud of myself for the things that I was accomplishing. And I thought, I'm going to build a life with this person and it's going to be great. And I did that. And I drank, and he knew I had a drinking problem, and he had been married prior to, as well. So he went through a divorce, and he was married to an alcoholic. And the reason why I say this is because this is so important as to part of my story with him. He worked for the fire department. He was a captain. We built his career together. He did. When I met him, he was a fireman. And then when we later on in life together, he was a captain with the fire department. And he was an overachiever. He was extremely smart. He was handsome. He swooped me off my feet. We had built this incredible life together. And everything that I was shooting for and everything that I set out to do, I did. And I had everything that I wanted in life. I had a beautiful home. I drove the car that I wanted. I had the wardrobe I've ever wanted. Back then, the popular thing was Juicy Couture tracksuits. And I had them in every color. And it was still never, ever enough. I was searching and seeking for always the next best thing. And I was a liar. I would hide things. I would hide shopping bags. Everything was always excessive. And I still drank. I would have a lot of bad nights and he would clean me up and everything would be okay. But it just continued to get worse and it continued to get worse. And I wanted to have a family. So it was like, all right, I'm going to clean myself up because now it's coming to the time that, you know, I want this family. And we couldn't have a family. We tried and we did everything that we could. And it turned out that he was unable to have a child. And he convinced me we could be live this great life, just you and I. We could travel and we could just drop everything and leave when we want. You know, we don't have to settle in California. It would be easier to move into a different state to retire. And I was starting to buy into this. But deep down, I was so unhappy and so miserable. All I could do was just drink. And I didn't use drugs. It wasn't part of my lifestyle. I didn't hang around people that used drugs. But I was always that girl that would overdrink. And I would drink before I went places. And I would have a couple cocktails and then get to the party or get to the dinner. And I could suck down like booze, like there was no tomorrow. It always gave me that ease and comfort. Soon as I would take that first drink, it was like, oh, I can breathe. I'm going to feel okay tonight. And I would think that everything would be good, but I would be the girl that would be throwing up in the bathroom later on that afternoon or later on the evenings and just say, oh my God, I must not have eaten all day, or I always had an excuse for bad behavior. I would always call to make sure I didn't make a fool of myself the night before with somebody. And with my parents, they would say things like, Michelle, we want you to come over, but you can't drink at our house, you know, because they would entertain. You know, we would have family parties. I had cousins and aunts, and we would get together for all the holidays. We were such a tight-knit family, but I was always the one that took it too far. And they would see it. My family would see it. And I could see that my parents would be on edge when I would come over and start drinking. And I wouldn't drink one drink. I would have four, five, and six to where I'd get intoxicated. And I would always say, I don't know what's worse, blacking out and not remembering what you did, or remembering what you did and have to pick up the phone to make sure nobody else was mad at you. Fast forward into our relationship, it started to decline because I was very unhappy. I would excessive shop and I would excessive drink. And I could remember my ex-husband's career was taking off and he decided to take a desk job with the fire department. So that way he could be at home at night and see what it is that I was doing. And I cried and kicked and screamed because I loved that schedule. He was gone 10 days a month. And those 10 days, I was able to do whatever I want, drink as much wine as I wanted, clean my house, go shopping, go into Belmont Shore, do whatever I wanted. And now things were about to change. And in the meantime, from all the drinking that I was doing, my body was changing. I was getting older. I was getting a lot heavier. I was always swollen. I wouldn't say I was always hungover, but I always had glazed eyes or my face was swollen and it was becoming a problem. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to drink this much, and when you finish drinking, you're overeating because you're hungry and you're going to eat whatever it is that you can get your hands on. And then I started to go into making myself sick. And so I would excessive drink and then I would make myself sick. And then I would excessive eat and then I would start making myself sick. And so I worked in the beauty industry. We worked a hair show and we used to work at the hair show in Long Beach and we owned a home. We had bought a home in Seal Beach and we had bought this beautiful home. Like I said, we were building our life there and I would work these hair shows once a year. And it was like, we just party. We would drink excessively, go to fancy dinners, and then we'd get up early and work the shows. And I could remember after a show, my feet were swelling, and I couldn't walk. And they were so swollen, I was scared. And I was overweight and malnourished and swollen. And I remember going to the doctor, and I weighed in at 190 pounds. And they looked at my feet, and they would touch my feet. And they said, you have pedal edema. This is caused from I was malnourished and from drinking, and I had too much sodium in my body. And they ran a bunch of tests and they had found that my triglycerin levels were so high that I could possibly have a stroke. And that still didn't stop me from drinking. And I remember going home with the paperwork and hiding the paperwork because my husband worked in the medical. You know, he was a fireman, paramedic. He had done it all. That if he saw this, he was going to know that there's a problem and that he's going to start hounding me even more to get off drinking. And so he found the paperwork, couldn't believe how much I weighed in on, and couldn't believe my score, my blood work had come back as bad as it did. Cholesterol, everything was really, really high. And he was telling me, this is serious. You need to get it together. You need to stop drinking. And then it came to a point where he's like, you can no longer drink in our house. And my parents were on board because they were now aware of this problem, but they already knew. But they also knew I didn't live at home. And so they had kind of lost control and I was on my own. They were busy working and I still drank and I managed to figure it out and be sneaky and hide things. And it was, my lying was even worse than ever. I used to drink a lot of wine and you could smell wine. And I could remember one night I was watching this movie. It was called When a Man Loves a Woman. And the reason why I say this is because there's a scene in the movie where she tells her husband, I was drinking vodka because you can't smell it. And I thought, whoa, okay, this might work for me. This might work. Let's see. Let's test the waters. And I started, rather than going to the grocery store to pick up my wine, I was now going to the local liquor store, which was around the corner from my house. And I would buy Absolut vodka. It wasn't the big bottle. It was like the half size bottle. And I knew exactly how much I could drink to get just a good enough buzz where nobody could tell, but I could feel good. I drank it and I could remember I gagged it down, but I also remember that feeling of feeling comfort as it burned down my throat. And I didn't care so much about the high. I just wanted to feel that ease and comfort. That's what I started drinking. And I would make up all these excuses that, you know, I didn't wash my hair. You're smelling the alcohol of stale hairspray in my hair. Like, I used to come up with the most elaborate lies to cover up my drinking. And I would hide bottles all over my house. And on Tuesday was trash day. And I would go and collect those bottles and I would count them to make sure I had exactly enough that matched the days of the week. And I would not leave for work until the trash was picked up. So that way I knew everything was gone. And if I missed trash day, I was at the gas station dumping bottles, or I was at the park dumping bottles. And I always knew I wanted something better for myself, but I didn't know how to stop. Did not know how to stop. And then I had this wild idea, because my family's now on me. I'm not allowed to go to their house and drink anymore. And I would stash bottles in my bags. And I thought, okay, if you're not going to let me drink, I'm going to bring my own drink and I'm just going to drink in the bathroom. And then I would drink in the bathroom and then I would throw the bottle away. And it was just this vicious cycle that went on and on and on. And I didn't know how to stop. And I didn't feel good about myself because I was the biggest liar there was. I loved the taste of alcohol. I loved the effect that it gave me. And I just wanted to feel better. And that's it. And I was burning my life to the ground and I couldn't even see it. And my ex-husband, now ex-husband, he would badger me. And all we did was fight. And there was no respect in our house. I had no respect for him. And I would say the most awful things to people, just not him, but to family members. And I would argue with them. I was arguing with my family. And I just wanted to feel better. And I thought, well, maybe if I go on a crash diet, I will start to feel better and I'm going to start to take care of myself. And this is going to jumpstart my recovery. Never did I have any exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just wanted to feel better. And I was looking for always something else to make me feel better. And I thought, maybe if I just go on a good diet, that will help me stay sober because I will be focused on feeling better and get my health in check. I'll get my weight in check. And I seeked out a diet doctor and I found her in Inglewood, California, and she ran a clinic. And I could remember driving over there and it was in the hood. I was in the hood and I didn't belong in the hood. And I went in and she took all my measurements, and because at this time I was a binge drinker and a binge eater, and I would drink till I threw up and I would eat till I threw up. And I was always putting my finger down my throat to throw up. And I was so malnourished and dehydrated. And when I went in to see this doctor, I remember she grabbed my skin and she grabbed my belly and said, "This is alcohol. This is sugar and this is alcohol." And I was like, "I don't have a drinking problem. I'm just overweight. I eat too much," which wasn't the case. I was an alcoholic and I had an eating disorder. She said, "Well, I'm going to put you on by by the looks of your heart rate, we're going to have to put you on this diet pill and we're going to, you know, monitor, and this is how many calories. And I went, I have an excessive personality. So now I'm obsessing over this diet. And I had lost 5 pounds in my first week because I went in and weighed with her. And I was like, oh, 5 pounds. Okay. So maybe I can just add a little bit of alcohol now. What's it going to hurt on the weekend? Vodka's good. There's no sugar in it. We can go this direction. So started to drink a little bit, and now I'm plateauing on this diet. And then I realized what kind of diet pills she had back there. And I have the gift of gab, and I work in sales, and I worked the girls at the front room, and they were giving me Fen-Phen. And Fen-Phen is now off the market. It's been off the market for quite some time. So now I'm high on diet pills all day long and drinking excessively at night to come off these diet pills. I didn't tell my husband at the time that this is what I had gotten my hands on. He thought that I was just being accountable to this like nutritionist, and I'm taking care of myself, and I'm at the diet doctor, and I'm taking this diet seriously, but then now I'm not losing weight. And everyone's going, well, how come you're not losing weight? You're following this diet. Well, I really wasn't following the diet, because now for breakfast, I'm eating a diet pill that's basically speeding me out all day, and I'm gagging down handfuls of cucumbers, because I needed a little something. And then at night I would drink, and then I would wake up at midnight starving and just eat excessively on anything that I can get my hands on. And then I'm throwing up. I'm binging. Now I'm binging. And it's this vicious, vicious cycle that I've gotten myself into. And I lived like that for, I want to say, good six months. And I want to say in 2009, is when the wheels fell off and I was in trouble. I had, it was my then husband's birthday, and I took the day off, and we were going to go shopping, and we were going to get things in order for our house because we wanted to remodel our kitchen, and we had saved money to remodel our kitchen. And I said, I'll be right back. I got to run to the grocery store because I don't want us to stop on our way home. And what I would do was I would go to the liquor store, I would get my bottle, go to the grocery store, buy things that we didn't need, and then our day would start. And I always bought a bottle big enough that fit in a makeup bag so I can just drink it and like take bathroom breaks and all that. And I remember something came over me and I just needed to drink. And I had some drinks, and I remember we were shopping, and he looked at me and goes, have you been drinking today? And I was like, no, I haven't been drinking. And he said, I think you've been drinking today, and I don't want to do this. We're going home. And I was on, you know, prescription diet pills, and I was drinking, and my moods were up and down. And we got home and I lost it. I just remember I flipped out, and he was screaming and yelling at me, and I was screaming and yelling at him. And I remember he packed a bag and he left. And I thought, okay. And I would always keep these secrets because it was a tit for tat relationship. I won't tell your parents if you do this, because I was close with my family. I never wanted to disappoint my family because I'd been disappointing them since I was 14 years old. And he had left, and he didn't come back for like, I want to say 3 days. And I had came home from work. I had no clue where he was. He had come home from work, and he gave me a bag. I had come home from work and he threw a duffel bag at me. And he said, you know what? He said, you are leaving our home. I am not leaving anymore. He said, you're not only an alcoholic, but you are a drug addict. And he threw my prescription diet pills. He goes, I'm not an idiot. I can read that prescription and know exactly what you're taking. And this explains everything. He goes, you are no longer welcome here. He goes, and I called your family and I told your family what's going on. And I was like, how dare you? How dare you? And I called my mom and dad and I said, can I come over? And my mom said, "Michelle, I am so sorry, but we are on his side. You cannot come to our house. You need to figure this out." So I said, "Fine, not a problem." And my choices were, do I go sit in a hotel by myself? Like, I had the money to pay for it, but I also didn't want to spend the money on this hotel. And so I had called my aunt, who I was very close to, who I grew up with and was closer in age than with her. She was more like my sister. And I had called her and asked her, "Can I come over?" And she said, "Yes, what's going on?" And I told her everything that was going on. And she said, "Shelly, come over." And I went and stayed with my aunt for a week to only find that her life was in shambles. She had two brand new babies and she had a husband that was pretty much absent in her relationship. And all I could think about was, all right, Chris, I can't deal with your shit. I just need to go home. I just need to go home. And whatever that looks like, I need to go home. My family had told me, you can come home, but you're going to treatment. And I'm like, I'm not going to treatment. And they said, that is the only condition that you can come into this house is if you go to treatment. So I said, fine, I'll go to treatment. And I wasn't willing to go to treatment to get sober. I was willing to go to treatment to get my stuff back because that's all I cared about. I wanted my home. I wanted my closet back. I wanted to go back to work. I wanted all these things back. That's all I cared about. And so I made a telephone call to a treatment center out in Palm Springs, California. I went to call the Betty Ford Center and I went home. I got my affairs in order. I went, drove down to the center and checked in and I was doing inpatient. And what I realized was when I was doing inpatient is, oh my God, shit got real. If I don't do this and take advantage of this thing that I have been given, I am going to die a slow, miserable death, totally alone. And I don't ever want to come back here. And I remember wiping away my tears and praying to a God that I was so uncomfortable with. I grew up Catholic, but I did not. We went to church on holidays, but I did not. My prayers were always, please, God, don't let me plow down our neighbor's kids. Please let me get home. Please let me not do this again. But I gave an honest prayer to God to please give me the strength to do what was in front of me. And I wiped away my tears. And I stayed there for 30 days and I did everything that treatment center told me to do. They addressed my eating disorder. They showed me a different way of life. They set me up for success. And they even told me when I was leaving, Michelle, you got this. You got this. Do 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor and take a commitment. And I said, I think I can do that. Now, mind you, I knew nothing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew what the treatment center provided me. But I could remember on my 30th day when I was leaving, when we were driving out home, I thought, oh my God, how am I going to do this? Like, I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. But they give you an alumni contact. And I called that woman. I took additional time off work and I called that woman and I said, I just got home from Betty Ford. They told me to call you and that you would help me. And she said, yes. She said, I'm going to a meeting tonight. I left treatment on Sunday and this was Monday. And I called her and she took me to a meeting on Monday night. She took me to our alumni services here in Long Beach. And I thought, oh, life is good. Everything's going to be great and grand. And I went back to work. I found a foundation. I went to the Hermosa Beach Alano Club because I worked in the South Bay. I did my 90 meetings and 90 days there. I went to the morning meeting every day before I went to work. I didn't say anything. I sat into the back of the room, but I was there. And that's all I cared about. They told me to just come. And I took a commitment at my alumni group. I was the chip girl for, I want to say, 2 years. And things were rocky still at home. I had done so much damage. The trust needed to be earned back. And mind you, my husband at the time had his shit too. And I want to say 2 years into my recovery, my life flipped upside down. That marriage I fought to hold on to, the house that I fought to hold on to, was now all going away because I was in the process of a divorce. And I also want to say, like, within those first 2 years of sobriety, I wasn't doing the work, but I was still showing up to the meetings. And I didn't really have a sponsor. I knew some people, but I wasn't active in recovery like I should have been. But I did have a whole new appreciation for my life. You know, I knew how to take care of myself. I ate better. When I was at the treatment center, they addressed my eating disorder. They reminded me of all the good nutritions and how to take care of me and not worry about everybody else. I knew my family was proud, but now I had made a mess of my marriage in sobriety and it was now over. And I remember I hit this fork in the road and thought to myself, you're either going to drink or you can get active in Alcoholics Anonymous and be okay. And that's the direction that I took. And I got a real sponsor and her name was Gina. And Gina walked me through that divorce with grace and dignity. I cried in every single meeting that I went to. And she's like, it's okay. Just share your story. That's all you need to do is if you get called on to share, you share what's going on and be honest. And I said, okay. And I did everything she told me to do because I just wanted to feel better. And I did the work and I did the steps and I met women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my house sold and I moved home with my parents. And I want to say I stayed with them for about 8 months. And in those 8 months, we had fun. My parents trusted me. We had a whole new experience. And then I had moved into my first condo and I was living alone and I was taking care of myself and I was doing great. And I continued on that path. I was active in recovery and I was sponsoring women and I was going to meetings and my life changed. I was honest and I was happy. And I'll share this part of my story because it's part of my story. And I got involved with somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was my first relationship from my divorce. And we were having fun. And that person relapsed. And he was involved in serious and harder drugs that I was familiar with. This person was into different drugs than I understood. And he turned into a liar, he turned into a cheat, and he turned into a thief. And now I was looking at myself in the mirror, and it was my recovery took a different turn because I was like, oh my God, I get it. I get what I did to my family. I get what I did to my ex-husband. And that shame and that guilt that I was feeling had all come back up into surface. I didn't know what direction to go. You know, I was constantly accountable to my sponsor and telling her what was going on. She never told me to leave this person, but I did not want this in my life at all. But I didn't know how to get rid of him. I did not know how to get rid of him because I felt sorry for him. And I made those amends to my family members. I made that amends to my ex-husband. And I'll get into that amends in a minute because it's such a powerful thing with him. But I had been dealing with this thing and he was now living in a sober living and I was detaching myself from the situation. I didn't want to abandon him, but I didn't want that in my life because that was a whole different thing that he was doing that I didn't understand and it was dangerous. The people that he ran around with were dangerous and I didn't want it anywhere near me because it was like, I worked so hard to have the things that I have by myself. I have a career that I don't ever want to lose and I don't want your things to interfere with what I'm having in my sanity. Like I wanted my sanity. That was so important to me was my self-care. And so he was on his own. He was in sober living. He was getting sober. And in the midst of all of this, I had done my steps. I had made my amends. But the one amends that I was never able to make was my ex-husband. And he had gotten married and got on with his life. And it was suggested that I write a letter and read it to my sponsor and make a living amends, you know, and just do that, a living amends, and be a better partner. And I was taught how to be in a relationship and be in an honest relationship. And, but it was never enough. And I always felt that guilt. And now I had seen firsthand what I had done to him. And so I had a friend who had passed away, and my ex-husband was the one to call me and tell me that Joelle had passed away. And I met him at the funeral, and we talked, and we had a good conversation, and he was going through a divorce. And I thought, wow, I'm going to be able to make that amends to him. And I called my sponsor and I told her, and I said, this is what's going on. I said, I met Joe at Joelle services. And I said, I feel like I'm ready to make that amends. I need to make this amends to him. And I ran it by my sponsor, Gina, at the time. And I called my therapist and I talked it through with my therapist. So they directed me and helped, guided me on how to do this. And I had picked up the phone and I had called him and I said, you know, would you be open to having coffee and having a conversation with me? I think it would be really good for us to get together and talk. I said, our marriage ended abruptly, and so everything was so horrible. I just would love to talk. And he was not open to it. And he said to me, I am not meeting you. Like something had shifted. And he's like, I am not meeting you. I am not opening this can of worms with you. This is just not a good idea. And he was very aggressive and very defensive. And I said, okay. I said, I understand. And I said, but when you're ready to talk, if and willing, please call me and we can get together. But I understand where you're at. I just wanted to reach out and see if you were open to it. And I said, and that's okay. And so I hung up and I thought, okay, I tried. He's not interested and I'm going to move on. He called me a week later and said, I'm ready for that coffee. And I met him. I gave him that amends. And then he actually made an amends to me. And it was powerful. It was what we both needed. And we became good friends after that, you know, and I had a relationship with him, and it was a relationship. I never thought he would ever speak to me again, but he appreciated that I took the time to address these things that I had done in our marriage. And he had appreciated that I had taken the time to address the things that I had done in our marriage. And everything that I was feeling, all the guilt, the shame that I felt, was now gone. Everything had gone. And I just got on and, you know, got on with my life. And that relationship that I had with that person, I ended. And fast forward into, I want to say 11 years, but I was turning 10, I was turning 11 years sober. My sponsor, Gina, who had sponsored me through everything, had made a decision that she wasn't open to sponsoring women anymore. But I had built such a fellowship that I was able to transition and work with Claudia, who helped me and has taken me to a different level of recovery. I've been with her for the last 4 years. I'm accountable to that woman. I call her for absolutely everything. I share my entire life with her. I share the bad and I share the good. I don't just want to call her when I have things going on. I want to call her and share when my life is good. And I have done the work, and my life today is great. It is simple. I appreciate those small things. I'm open when I get those God shots. I have a relationship today, and it's one of those things where my life came full circle. My childhood boyfriend that I loved and who was my true love is now back in my life, and we've been together for 3 years and we have a home full of love, and he's not in the program. He's a normie. and he loves and respects Alcoholics Anonymous because he knows that this is part of my life and he's made it part of his life. And he tells me often, he's like, Michelle, I love your friends more than I love my own. He said, they're so kind and they're so loving. And you, when you speak of your friendships, you women build each other up. You don't tear each other down. He's attended different meetings because he wants to support my friends when they're taking birthdays and anniversaries. And he does those funny potlucks, those alcoholic potlucks that we go to. And we have a good life together. And I wouldn't have any of those things if I wasn't sober. You know, I have the love and support of family. I'm a good daughter. I'm a good aunt. I'm a good sister. I'm a good relative. And I learned how to be a woman of grace and dignity in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am extremely grateful to be here and extremely grateful that Tara reached out to me to share my experience and my strength and hope with you. So thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. So thank you for your share, Michelle. I loved listening to your story. It's just the favorite, my best time of my week is listening to these stories. And then the job that I have is, where can I ask questions that would add value to your story? You mentioned looking for something else to make you feel better when you were in this vicious cycle. Do you have the feeling today of restlessness where you're seeking something to feel better? And if so, what does that look like?
I wouldn't say. I think what I seek for today is nothing to make myself feel better. I think it's seeking to be successful in all my affairs. As far as, like, I always want to make sure I'm a good person. I do things with integrity. I always want to make sure I'm doing things like I want to be the best at my career, whatever that looks like. I want to be a good employee. I want to be a good daughter. Those are the things that I seek for today. It's not necessarily about me. It's about just being a good person. Before, it was filling this void that I felt of never self-worth. I felt like the clothes would make me feel better. The hair would make me feel better. Those things, it was like surface things trying to make me feel better. Today, it's like, I just want to be of service and help another person, whether it be a family member or just being successful in my career.
You spoke about the Betty Ford Center and shit getting real. Two questions around this.
Sure.
How did you leave there, as you said, set up for success, but without deep knowledge of AA?
They set you up with an alumni contact in your area. And so when they set you up, I was living in Seal Beach. And so my alumni contact lived in Long Beach. So they give you the phone numbers for you to call fellow alumni. And that alumni will connect you with other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and or they'll take you to meetings. So my contact took me to the MWA in Long Beach on a Monday night. And she introduced me to other women. And then I went to Betty Ford has an alumni meeting in Long Beach. So fellow alumni, families, and friends can go to this meeting. So I would go there, and that's where I took my first commitment. So I met people in there that went into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And with that too, I failed to say this, is that I do a lot of service work for Betty Ford. It's now Hazleton, but I do a lot of service work. So the alumni offices will call me and tell me, Michelle, we have an alumni in your area. She's going to reach out. We gave her your number. Could you get her to a meeting? And so I have, I think, three alumni that I'm working with right now that are in my local area.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. set up there.
Yeah, they do a lot of, they gave you a lot of tools to go home with, you know, and then it's up to us to use those tools. And it's very unfortunate because, and one of the reasons why too, is I paid to go to Betty Ford, that kitchen that I talked about, and there's things that I missed in my story that cost, that was the cost of me to go to Betty Ford. And the way I look at it is I paid to get sober, you know, and I went in there for all the wrong reasons, but I stayed for all the right reasons. And I don't ever want to give that up. I hold on to my date tight. I hold on to my sobriety tight.
When you were sharing that you left Betty Ford, it was very much the language you were using was as if you were going to go out again. But I think you were leading up to, you know, your divorce and losing the house. You lost the house anyway, so you didn't need the new kitchen. It worked out perfect.
Perfect. I know. I know. And I got kicked in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, Gina kicked my ass in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I spent a lot of time on my story and not how I got sober. So I had a lot of stuff happen in my recovery, like a lot of loss. And I walked through it sober. And it was because of the women that I had walking with me. Gina did great things for me in recovery. She kicked me in the middle of everything and said, did you raise your hand and share today? You know, nobody's going to get to know you unless you start sharing. Don't pass. Nobody's judging. Nobody cares. They want to hear your story and they want to get to know you. And I was like, okay, I can do this. I can do this. I have the gift of gab, you know, but when I would share, I would cry all the time. And everyone's like, oh my God, she's crying again. That's where I was. Cause that was the only thing I knew how to do. And things just got better and better.
Is there anything that you're thinking of now that you left out of your story?
I thought that with my ex-husband, that was so important because we do so many living amends. The ex-boyfriend that I spoke about was real. He was part of my story a lot because he was in and out. And I even said that in the story that it was like, oh my God, I'm living what I put my family through. And I think that's so important. And I did Al-Anon. I went to Al-Anon, you know, because Gina suggested I go there. And I did a lot of work to get rid of that relationship because it was going nowhere. And I didn't want any part of it. I didn't want any part of it. And he and I are friends today, but at a distance.
And like your parents, you're now back with your high school sweetheart.
Yes. He was my one true love. Like our story came full circle and I didn't get to share about that, but we do have so much love in our home and he loves and appreciates Alcoholics Anonymous. Like he does not interfere with anything that has to come with recovery. And it's finding a balance of relationship and work life and AA. But if I'm sponsoring a woman and I'm doing step work and all of those things, he does not give me a hard time about anything. He loves the women and men in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Final question for the alcoholic out there listening, suffering, what would you like to leave with them?
To trust the process. To hold onto your seat, to reach out to others in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, ask for help. Let us love you. Let us love you.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.